This is the Authentic Persuasion Show. Hey, everybody, Jason Cutter here. Welcome to the Authentic Persuasion Show. This episode is the second segment with my friend, Professor Tom Coates from MTSU's Center for Professional Selling. If you didn't check it out, make sure to check out part one, which is on authenticity. Now we're going to talk about persuasion. Just so you know, in case you didn't catch it, Professor Tom is the director of the Center for Professional Selling at Middle Tennessee State University. He is a teaching professional. He's helping the future of sales and sales leadership. People who are in a sales discipline or all walks of life in MTSU's various programs, learning how sales could benefit them. And like we covered in part one, everything in life is sales. And so there's benefit and value in those kind of courses for the future of the salespeople. So again, we're going to talk about persuasion. Professor Tom, are you ready? Welcome to part two.
Hey, let's do it.
All right. So again, we talked about authenticity in the first piece. It's funny because at one point you mentioned, you know, how sometimes students have these assumptions and preconceived notions where, all right, so to be successful in sales, I have to do this, or just I just have to know some special phrase. If I know something that's going to help me, like what's the one thing to say to close deals? And then that's what sales is all about. I always tell people like some of those things could be effective. That's the persuasion piece. If you don't have the authentic foundation, it's all wasted because you have to do certain things and be who you are and understand things. The H to H side we talked about before this, let's say the tactics and the strategies and the art and the science of sales comes in. That's where we are now, right? So that's the persuasion piece. If you had to look back on what you've done sales-wise, like you said, from the hood of the truck to the boardroom sales modes that you've had in your career, and again, people who tuned in to part one will understand that, and what you see now, is there any favorite sales processes or frameworks that come to mind or things that you found work well from a persuasion standpoint?
Okay. Let's first talk about the roadblocks that we can have to the conversation.
Okay.
And you mentioned assumptions. And have you read Voss's book on Never Split the Difference?
I actually haven't. I've heard a ton about it, but I've never read it.
There's several things in this book that I so wish that I had this in my 20s and 30s. It would have been so much easier. And the things that he points out are things that I have picked up through the years, but he articulates it so well. But one of them is talk about assumptions. Assumptions blind. Strategy guides. So when you're going to persuade somebody, you want them to do a certain thing. You want them to purchase your service or your product. You know, first off, you if you go in with an assumption about what's going to happen or a certain type of individual, you are blinded to things that may be different. But if you go in with a strategy of how this conversation should work, then you're open to different possibilities. That's why we use the sales lab at the university to practice those sales conversations, but they're not scripted. One of my just brilliant students, Nadia, she sat there at the beginning of the class, and she actually was writing out a script of what she was going to say word for word and what her prospect was going to say word for word. And I looked at her and said, Nadia, I love the fact that you are so meticulous and so organized. And my friend, she was. Her notes were color-coded. It was incredible. She was an incredible student. But I needed her to understand that the sales conversation is not a one-act play. It is a conversation that ebbs and flows. It's the difference between cooking and baking. Yeah, if you're a baker, then you measure things. Everything has to be precise. You do things at a certain time, and it has to be the same way every time to get the same results. Thank you. Cooking, is a little bit of this, a little bit of that. You kind of ease it into it. Is it going to be the same every time? No, that's the joy of cooking. You know, so a sales conversation is that, because human beings are not robots. They're going to respond in different ways. They're going to respond to things that and misunderstand things, and then actually be way ahead of you on other things. They're just so much fun. And so if you're going to persuade human beings, you have to be open to the fact to allow them to be human and not to make those assumptions that will steal you from opportunity. Zig Ziglar, a great Mississippian, he wrote in his book that he sold pots and pans door to door back in the day. And he goes, he was so good at predicting if the person could buy his stuff that he would pull up in front of their house and would know if they could do it or not. And being that good, he almost starved to death because he was making assumptions, not a strategy, and not presenting everybody with the same opportunity. So first off, we need to avoid assumptions so that we can be persuasive. And then after that, there's several tactics, ways that we could go about. Going back to the Voss book, yeah, he has recommendation for three different voices that a sales professional should have, which if you're a parent, you already know these voices. You have your normal everyday voice that your child is going to respond to quite well. And then you have that authoritative voice that is going to, you know, and you use that voice on your child and redirect their behavior, but not to crush their soul. And then the third voice is what Voss calls the late night DJ voice. Now, you're too young to remember the late night DJ, but the smoky voice of that Friday night DJ, and just a deep voice. And so that voice is a voice that you would use just like a parent with a child, and you start separating syllables and you lower that tone just a little bit so that you could just push away all of that static that can interfere with that conversation. And you go, "I'm sorry, Jason, what part of this are we missing?" And when you do that, you separate the syllables, you lower that pitch, then that all that attention comes right back to you. And the only way that you could help persuade somebody is if you can communicate properly. You have to remove all that static. I spent quite a bit of time with my students talking about communication. Because, you know, we make our living, you know, speaking. Well, we probably should think it through before we do it. As you can well tell, I'm Southern. I'm very Southern. I grew up, 50 miles off the Gulf Coast in South Mississippi. My language is English, but we're so casual with our English in Mississippi that you probably would not understand us. The colloquialisms, it's just beautiful the way that we use them. That's cute and gets you go, well, say that again when you travel. But if you're really going to communicate with people, you need to use a standard English. You know, you need to make sure to minimize those colloquialisms, make sure that you use appropriate language. For instance, here's an example. You're familiar with what a water hose is for your yard. In Middle Tennessee, in certain rural counties, that's a yard pipe or a water pipe. Who ever heard of that? Or the package of cheese crackers in Mississippi, we call those nabs because the brand is Nabisco. Well, you need to recognize that that's a regional term and not something that other people would understand. If you're going to communicate with people, you need to make sure you speak in a a language and manner that they'll understand. People my age would use, you know, terms like Reader's Digest version, and we're quite comfortable with that. People that are in their 30s have no clue what that means, and it just means a condensed, more precise story. You know, if we want to communicate with Gen Z and Gen X and millennials, then we need to speak a language that they understand. So that's part of being persuasive is not doing assumptions and making sure that you communicate appropriately and do away with as much static as possible. And that noise, that static that we're talking about would be, you know, language that we use, terminology, those type of things. And then being persuasive is just being a real human with each other. You know, if you believe in what you're talking about, then you're going to be persuasive. And then how do you handle yourself when people don't agree? Matter of fact, right now in my professional selling class, we're covering objections. Because I talked to the students, I said, okay, yeah, I know you cannot imagine, but sometimes people disagree with you. And they go, like, yeah. I said, can you think of a moment? They said, yeah. I said, well, let's here's some tactics, some techniques that we use to handle that. And so I gave them a list of several different ways that we could handle that. And I gave them a cycle of process. It's not magic words. It's not a universe that's always going to work. But if you hear the same objection all the time and you give a pause, because that's the first time that person has given you the objection, even though you possibly have heard it 10 times already this week. You give a pause, you repeat it back to them in appropriate language, because, you know, sometimes they don't use the right wording, and that confirms you're on the same page. And then after that, they confirm that, yeah, you're on the same page. Then you use the appropriate rebuttal technique. And then if you've done that, then you ask for that little yes, which is, you know, did that answer your question? And so we ended up, actually last Thursday, we ended up playing the Feel, Felt, Found game. And Feel, Felt, Found is an old school rebuttal technique. It's kind of like the universal donor of rebuttals. You know, I can understand how you might feel about that, which is acknowledging that yeah, I hear you. Others have felt that way, letting you know that that's normal and very human of you. But if what you would find, others have found, and now you're explaining why we should go this route, it's a nice little process. So we practice that in class, and the way we do the game is I'll ask them, you know, like, you know, what's your favorite, you know, car? And they'll tell me. And then I say something snarky about that car. You know, like, really? Are you 50? You know, and they go, well, I understand how you might feel, you know, that car is more for an older person. Others have felt that same way. But what I found is, and so they go through that process, so they have to think it through. Being able to do things like that and have a legitimate answer, it's all part of persuasion. You know, there's not a magic wording. There's not a magic phrase or a magic process. It's being a human being. A big part of being persuasive also is understanding the needs of the other. You know, if you listen, then you're going to be able to be persuasive, which sounds counterintuitive because persuasive means talking, but you have to listen in order to know how you're going to help the other individual. In my classes, I use the spin as a process. You know, situation questions, problem questions, implication questions, needs, payoff. It's old school. It's very simple. If processes like this were flavor of ice cream, this one would be vanilla. because it's so straightforward. But my students can go to any business and adapt to their process, asking the questions, understanding their problems, and then being persuasive and explaining the story, telling the story how this product or this service would solve that problem. You know, the biggest thing is that being persuasive is being able to tell that story where the client is the hero of the story and puts themselves in the position of using that service or that product. And when you could tell the story to where it makes sense to them to put themselves in that, then it works out. Does that make sense? I feel like I've rambled a little bit.
You covered a lot of stuff, and it's interesting because as you're going through this, I'm taking notes and things that I wanted to add to, and then you just kept going with more on it, which was great. Yeah, and I love all that.
Yeah.
No, it's one of those things where it was like I wanted to add to it, and then you it said what I was going to say anyway, and I was like, this is fantastic. Anybody wants a great summary masterclass on, you know, the sales process and persuasion, that bit right there was definitely worth re-listening to. With that being said, because the things that you said, here's one thing that jumps out when I listen to you or anybody talk about sales, is that like a, let's say a chainsaw, I don't know why, but that came to my mind first. It can be used for good or evil, right? Like it can help cut down a tree and keep you warm during the winter, or it can do bad stuff like you see in the movies. So even with what you said, there is an element of, okay, but that is used for sales and persuading, but where is the line between persuading and manipulating for my benefit? And I literally don't care what happens to you. People who take literally the masterclass you just went through and is like, all right, cool. Now I know how to get people to buy from me, and I don't really care because now I can spin and feel felt found my way through anything, right? Where is that line? Or where do you see, let's say, you know, people that you're working with, the students, where they're torn or they don't understand the line between persuading and manipulating?
Yeah. We talk a lot about ethics in my class, and I have a very strong belief on ethics. It's there's two ways you could view ethics. One is do the least harm. So that approach would be, you know, this is a good solution, but it's not the best solution, but it's a good solution, and I'll make money. Okay. Do the least harm. Or there's the more binary choice of it's either right or it's wrong. And that's the camp that I land in. This is either the right solution or the wrong solution, and I will tell you. Hmm. And what I have found that by following that binary choice, I've made so much more money and had so much more success because people know that I will always have their best interests in heart, regardless of mine. Because how can I serve you if my first choice is serving myself? Yeah, it's incredible. The do the least harm approach, I understand it, but to me it's just weak.
Yeah, it feels like somebody who's playing the gray area to justify why it's okay to put themselves still first in a situation.
Yeah, and if you can justify that first thing, then you can justify doing that next one and that next one and that next one. And at some point, you have just completely gone off the deep end. And ethics, it has to be a binary choice. It's either right or it's wrong. So let's bring it back to being persuasive. Are there people that are persuasive that are not good people? Yes. Are there human beings that are not good people? Yes. I happen to be one of the people that believe very strongly that the majority of folks in this world are good people. I believe very strongly in a economy that is infinite, abundant economy with good people rather than a finite economy with limited resources, limited opportunities, and you've got to get what you can right now or you'll miss out. That's just a very short-minded, weak-minded approach to life. That's that gray area. That's where you could justify yourself by bending the rules to get things done. If you believe in an economy of abundance, abundant opportunity out there, then if you miss this chance, it's not the end of the world because you've got 10 more waiting for you right around the corner. Go find them. Never feel cheated because you did not have success in this moment, because your success is, did you do the right thing? Did you do the best you could for that individual? And if you did, then that individual will remember, you'll have that reputation. That reputation is the only thing that you carry from one company to another. And if you have that reputation, that people know that you will serve them and take care of them, my friend, you should have a very good career in sales.
All right, so last question. On the heels of that, which, you know, looking at it from abundance, I mean, I totally agree. 8 billion people on the planet. There's no reason you need to force or trick or manipulate anyone into buying from you if you have something of value. There's enough people out there who should want it, unless you're selling crap that the world doesn't need. Then that's another audience that's not, you know, for either of us. So on that, right? So not about forcing, tricking, manipulating people. When we're talking about persuasion, being a professional salesperson, like, why do you think people don't buy, given all of that that we've been talking about?
Well, I teach my students about the three S's. You're probably familiar with them. Some will, some won't, some what. You cannot carry their poor decision around on your back. You know, if you start carrying those no's around on your back, then that gets awfully heavy. It's very similar to baseball. You're going to get tremendously more no's or strikeouts than you get base hits. So you can't worry about that. It's not a big deal. Yeah, so why do people say no? Well, I'm convicted in the belief that there's four primary fears that buyers have, that you need to solve one or more of those fears. And if you haven't gotten a yes, then you probably did not solve one or more of those fears. And those fears are making money, saving money, being efficient enough, and staying out of the government's way. And if you could solve one or more of those fears with the buyer, then you have a likelihood of saying, getting a yes. Every time? No way. We're all human. So, but if you can solve those fears, then you're closer. And if you've done the best job that you can, you've listened appropriately, you presented a good, solid solution at a fair price, and they still say no. Okay, next.
That's it. I love it. I think that's awesome. That's a great place to leave it. I love those three S's and the four primary fears and what those represent. And really what the focus of a salesperson is to identify a need, to see if you can help somebody get to a better place, and then overcoming those things, which, again, a lot of people look at sales as something different. It's these, you know, tactics and strategies for this thing, and I got to do this. It's like, but if you boil it down to what you said in the first part, which is H to H, once you understand humans, then it's a completely different game. The product is less important than the human that you're dealing with. And that's where the art and science of sales comes in. For people who want to follow up, and again, this is going to be in the show notes. You're on LinkedIn, Tom Coates, THOMCOATS. And I know you're active on there. Also, if people want to check out your program at Middle Tennessee State University, it's mtsu.edu. And if you want the full URL, it's going to be in the show notes, but it's /professional-selling. Again, Professor Tom, I appreciate you being here. And I'm excited for part three, which is going to be on the future of sales and where it's going, especially relative to what you've seen. So again, thank you for being on and having this conversation about persuasion.
Thank you.
And as always, I appreciate everybody tuning in. Thank you for being a part of my mission to help fill the world with authentic persuaders, to shift the way sales is done with, you know, what we just spoke about and what Professor Tom was talking about with persuasion versus manipulation and you know, the ethics behind it. Obviously, anything and everything that we all do in the world of sales helps shift that in the mind of us as buyers, where we actually want to deal with a salesperson instead of being worried about it. So thank you for being a part of this journey. And until next time, thank you for helping fill the world with authentic persuaders.